Hello again, and welcome to the Planet Beyond Ocean Decade mini-series, recorded here, live, in Barcelona. In this mini-series, we will be exploring the issues discussed during the conference. Today, I'm joined by three conference participants, Eileen Tan, Jean-Pierre Gattuso, and Pooja Mahapatra. Eileen is director of the Center for Marine and Coastal Studies, University Sans Malaysia. Jean-Pierre is research director at the French Laboratory of Oceanography in Villefranche, part of the French National Center for Scientific Research. Pooja is principal advisor for climate and nature at Fugro. Eileen and Jean-Pierre were part of the first plenary session. In this session, they and other speakers explored the science and solutions for a clean, healthy, and resilient ocean. Pooja has been working on a new project for the Italian government that will help provide the data needed to manage a healthy ocean. Jean-Pierre, Eileen, Pooja, welcome to Planet Beyond. Eileen, Jean-Pierre, you've both been leading research into the health of our oceans and possible solutions. As scientists, do you think we have a good enough understanding of the ocean and our impact on it?
I personally feel we have not done enough or know enough of our ocean to find a solution for our ocean. Reason is because 70% of our Earth is covered with ocean, and we only know about 10% of the information about the ocean. We still have about 90% more unknown things about the ocean. So that leaves us a lot of things to do. You know, all of us will be very busy, the scientists, the other stakeholders, the policy makers, even down to the ground of the community.
I think we do. There are a lot of knowledge gaps, of course, but the bottom line is that we know enough to act and solve some of those issues. We know a lot. We know that the ocean is, with respect to climate change, is moderating climate change. It absorbs a quarter of human release of CO2 in the atmosphere, moderating the change in climate. The ocean also takes up more than 90% of the excess energy related to CO2 release. That means that the ocean is warming. And also the ocean is losing oxygen and losing and also accommodating, you know, 100% of the fresh water released from the loss of glaciers and sea ice. So the ocean is clearly a very important actor of the climate system. In fact, my colleagues, climatologists, say that the climate is slave to the ocean.
So the implementation part, we are finding solution. We know the issues. We scientists are now coming up with some solutions, but we have yet to translate the solutions into implementation, into actions, what I call actionable solutions.
We have knowledge gaps and they must be filled as soon as possible, but it's not a reason to act because we know what is generating those major climate extremes. And we know what has to be done. We have a framework to do that, and that is called the Paris Agreement. So the lack of knowledge in some areas is not a justification for not acting.
And the ocean is key to the future of our planet. Jean-Pierre, I think you summed up our relationship with the ocean so powerfully in the plenary session here in Barcelona. Let's listen to that recording for a moment.
There is a big urgency indeed. The ocean is a key actor of the climate system. It has climatologists say that the ocean, the climate is slave to the ocean. The ocean controls climate on geological timescales. It absorbs 25% of anthropogenic CO2 emissions. It also stores more than 90% of the excess energy related to human release of CO2. It also receives almost all the fresh water coming from the loss of glaciers and ice, sea ice. But this comes, it's a huge service provided to humanity, but it comes at a cost. The cost of ocean warming, marine heat waves, the loss of oxygen, sea level rise. So the ocean is an actor and a victim of climate change, but it's also a source of solution.
One of the challenges the Ocean Decade aims to address is developing and sharing data. There's been some fantastic developments in monitoring systems in recent years. Can you share some of the successes? Let's be positive for a moment. Can you share some of the successes the scientific community has had in developing ocean data? And do you think these go far enough?
Okay, the improvement in data generation is absolutely stunning the past decades. If you add, I'll mention two programs, the satellite imagery, looking at the surface ocean from space, has improved the data considerably, both in number, in coverage, and in the number of parameters studied. Temperature can be measured, the ocean color, which is related to the productivity of the ocean, sea level is also monitored from space. So it has improved tremendously what we know about the ocean. Because obviously, until the time that satellites became available, also, ocean observation was only performed by boats. Mm. And, you know, the ocean is so vast that boats, I mean, they couldn't cover a lot of ground and also couldn't have repeated measurements like satellites can do. You know, some parameters are measured throughout the surface ocean every day. That's something that cannot be achieved by field observations. The second program that has improved the knowledge of ocean is the Argo program. Argo floats are floats that go up and down in the water column every 10 days. They stay at the surface, then they sink to usually 2,000 meters. They stay put for 10 days at the bottom, and then they come back up. And while they go up and down, they measure a wide range of parameters, temperature, salinity, and also some biogeochemical variables. So those floats are tremendously useful to observe the deep ocean because the satellites only observe the skin of the ocean, you know, the first few 10 meters maybe. So the Argo program is fantastic. Now the Argo program has floats that go down to 4,000 meters, increasing again the amount of ocean volume that is monitored. And there are 4,000 Argo floats at the moment. So it looks a big number, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, but in fact, when you see the dots on the ocean, it is not very big.
Not quite so impressive.
You know, so there is a big need to improve this system, to improve also add more satellites and more variables. So there is a big scope for increasing data collection.
I've got a few other questions here that we'd love to hear your perspective on.
Your research looks at one of the most biodiverse regions in the world. It's helped you develop a wealth of data. But is it easy for you to share your data with other scientists and stakeholders around the world? Are the public sector funders of your research always happy to see raw data shared openly?
There is restriction. There is restriction being imposed by the government in the region in terms of sharing the data because it used, you know, the history actually has indicated that many years back in history, a lot of times data being collected by other countries and been taken it out of the country, and issues with commercialization, issues with IP, and some or other end up belonging to other countries rather than the country where those resources are found. So that is why, you know, for countries in our region where it's high biodiversity, the government are extra sensitive in terms of sharing information. But if we were to do it in a correct way, following the procedure, following the requirements required, there is no issue in sharing. It just takes time.
Should we spend more time waiting on a perfect understanding of the ocean, or is it more the case that we know enough already and now we need to act?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to give the impression of a scientist, you know, whinging for more money. There is enough knowledge to act.
Yeah.
You know, the IPCC has raised the alarm since the 90s about not the climate in general, but about the ocean.
IPCC stands for Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It is an intergovernmental body of the United Nations whose job it is to advance scientific knowledge about climate change caused by human activities. Now, back to Jean-Pierre.
And I was a co-author of an IPCC report on the ocean and cryosphere published in 2019, and it's crystal clear that the ocean is a main actor of the climate system and that it is a victim, as I said earlier. And also, we looked at solutions, and the ocean can be used to moderate climate change. But the ocean cannot do everything that needs to be done. I mean, the ocean-based solutions cannot replace the reduction of greenhouse gases emission. I mean, this is the most important thing to do to decrease the release of methane and CO2 in the atmosphere. And then there is a little contribution can be asked at the ocean, and we are looking, investigating technological approaches and also nature-based approaches in the ocean that could help moderate climate change.
Can you share some examples?
Yes, there are two broad categories of solutions that can be used. The first one is nature-based solutions. And for example, there are what we call blue carbon ecosystems. Those ecosystems are mangroves, salt marshes, and seagrass beds. These are so vegetated ecosystems. They are plants doing photosynthesis, that is using CO2 to make organic matter. And as it happens, part of this organic matter is, when the plant dies, is stored in the sediment, similar to the soil on land. So a fraction is stored of carbon is stored in the sediment, so it helps mopping up CO2 from the atmosphere. So conserving those ecosystems is very important, because when you destroy them, you cut a mangrove forest, and then the carbon which has been accumulated over hundreds of years is then released to the atmosphere, because these microbes will chew on this organic matter, and the CO2 will be released. So it must be conserved and restored whenever it is possible. And there are great examples of mangrove restorations, restoration in the delta of Mekong in Vietnam. After the Vietnam War, almost 60% of the mangrove forest in the Mekong Delta was destroyed by the use of napalm, for example. In about 50 years, this mangrove has been restored by mostly by local communities. It must be said that mangroves are the most, the easiest plants to restore, because you know, you just seed, provide, you know, young plants. You just put them in the sediment, and they grow as a forest. But still, it shows that there is a lot of scope. And now this forest is playing the role it played before. Mm. It was destroyed, you know, taking up CO2 from the atmosphere and storing some of it in the soil. So that's efficient. That being said, nature-based solutions are not a magic bullet. They can absorb maybe, once restored, maybe 1 or 2% of human CO2 released to the atmosphere. So it's not magic, but it has a lot of co-benefits in terms of food security. Mm. Because lots of fish go in mangroves to reproduce then move elsewhere. So it provides fish for local communities. It is a fantastic barrier, those ecosystems, for coastal protection, protecting the coastline from erosion. Mm. And also they maintain biodiversity, lots of plants and animals living within the mangroves.
Pooja, I know you've recently been working on a nature-based solution. Here at the Ocean Decade, you presented a poster related to seagrass conservation and restoration. Do you want to tell us why seagrass is so important?
The value of seagrass, they are the lungs of the ocean. They are disappearing at an incredible rate. And in fact, we don't even know where we have seagrass on our planet. Believe it or not, less than 20% of global seagrass has been mapped in any kind of way.
According to the World Wide Fund, seagrass capture carbon up to 35 times faster than tropical rainforests and account for more than 10% of the total ocean carbon storage.
Now that's staggering.
That is, isn't it? So we've recently won a project, and we're doing this together with the Italian government, where we are mapping the entire coastline of Italy. And if you can think of Italy on the map, you know that it has an incredibly long coastline.
Can you share a number?
I can. We're talking about approximately 12,600 square kilometers of total project coverage.
Wow.
And we're doing that at multiple scales. So
right.
We're doing quite low resolution over the entire area, but we're zooming in with multiple different technologies. So we are using satellite technology, we are using drones, we are using vessels, and we're using airplanes to collect data from different kinds of sensors at different resolutions, all the way down to the level of actually flying cameras near the seagrass to determine how healthy they are. Because the ocean carbon sequestration that you talked about earlier, that only works if seagrass is healthy. If seagrass is unhealthy or dying, they're actually carbon emitters, which actually contributes to the problem.
Yeah.
So it's exceedingly important to understand not only where the seagrass is, but how healthy it is to be able to do preservation and conservation efforts. And so that's what we're doing with the government of Italy. They have a very ambitious program called MER, the Marine Ecosystem Restoration Project. And it's really the first of its kind that a government is focusing on such an important problem and taking steps to get the right data that they need to make decisions around conservation and restoration.
When you say right data, of course, I'm imagining that it's about not just where they are, but as you just said, about the health of the plant. That's the right data. Now, forgive me, but I don't know what you would be collecting to measure the health.
Yeah.
Can you just expand on that?
Absolutely. So we're working with a very innovative startup company called Plan Blue, who have a hyperspectral camera that can acquire this sort of close-range imagery together with RGB imagery. Mm. And using very clever AI methods, you're able to actually pinpoint what parts of the seagrass are healthy and what are not. So we're using that to sort of ground truth and validate the multi-scale and the larger scale data that we're collecting using other kinds of sensors. So it's really quite groundbreaking. Mm. And the challenge of this project is actually integrating all of these different types and dimensions of data into a form that's actually usable by decision makers. So what we're also investing in for this project is building these decision support tools, what we're calling Vergio within Fugro, to really be able to put together all these, fuse all of these different data sets and actually present it in a way that's actionable for the government stakeholders.
The work you're doing with the Italian government, Pooja, really is leading the way in science-driven policy making. But we're talking about a rich nation in the global north. Eileen, your region is one of the most biodiverse in the world. At the same time, many of its citizens are very vulnerable to climate change, and your government has more obstacles to action. A big challenge for scientists is how to make sure that the data they collect, the facts they reveal, the solutions they propose, reach everyone who matters. You explained that very clearly in the plenary session.
We are talking a lot about engagement with stakeholders, but we are still talking among ourselves. If we are willing to come out from our ivory towers, from our lab, and talk and communicate and with the stakeholders, policymakers, communities, local authorities, we scientists have what I would say in our region. We are now in the process of unlearn and relearn how to speak our science in a different language that can be understood by everyone.
I love the unlearn, relearn model. It's particularly powerful coming from all of you who have learned so much in your careers. But how do you do that in practice?
The scientists need to unlearn and relearn how to communicate the science in the language. You know, I'm not talking about English or Chinese or Spanish. We are talking in terms of making scientific terms simple for the public to understand. For example, back home, instead of using temperature rise or ocean acidification or deoxygenation, I'm using common words like the ocean is getting hotter, sour, and breathless. Mm. The public would immediately understand.
It's great that you're helping Malaysians who maybe aren't from a scientific background understand what is happening to our ocean. It's perhaps something that we could all learn from. We all have fellow citizens who've never had a chance to get to grips with the science. At the same time, scientists need to speak to key stakeholders. With change possible at every election, it can be hard to build the relationships needed with policymakers. And as Eileen told us at the plenary session in Barcelona, that is what she and her colleagues have been doing in Penang, one of Malaysia's fastest growing cities.
I think the scientists will have to play the lead role in convincing the policymakers. But sadly, the policymakers, their vision is 3 years, 5 years, maximum 5 years because of their election term, you know, their commitment. You know, by the time you manage to convince them, it's time they change another. You have to convince another person in the ministry. You know, so it's something. It's challenging, but that can be done.
While Pooja's monitoring will help preserve healthy seagrass in Italy, Eileen's work has helped deliver a marine sanctuary for seagrass in an urban environment. A world first. The Middle Bank has been scheduled for development until University Sans Malaysia Centre for Marine Science and Coastal Studies, or CMACS, presented evidence on its biodiversity.
We have done once on converting marine sanctuary, you know, back home. It's in the city. You know, we are pushing to conserve it because the area is high diversity, and initially everybody say it cannot be done because it's in the urban setup. Conservation usually done in a remote area, but we have managed to convince the policymakers through many engagement. It took us 3 years to make it a reality. Even though it's 3 years, but it can be done. It has proven it can be done. So I think the scientist has to take the lead role in many things to, if we believe in moving the agenda of Ocean Decade.
People living in a city like Penang will see change in the ocean they live alongside. Some might need the reasons for them explained in familiar terms, not the sort of jargon you learn during a geography or ecology postgrad degree. But those same coastal communities will have their own insights. Are they getting a chance to explain the changes they see to the rest of the world?
Yes, you know, our region, Western Pacific, falls into the region with the highest level of biodiversity. And coincidentally, we are also falls under the countries that is most vulnerable to climate change and the impacts. Sadly, in this platform, you know, today in the Ocean Decade Conference, I think we are underrepresented. You know, our voices are not heard.
Really?
So I would like, you know, what I would really like to see is to pledge, you know, their commitment to come forward to tell, you know, to narrate their own, to communicate their own narrative, share their stories, because it's no point at the later stage when things has been set, the direction's been set, and it's no point we been in a small little area complaining that, oh, our voice are not been heard, not been captured. But this is the opportunity for us to come forth, to express. So grab the opportunity and express our concern, you know, because climate impact different countries differently.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to tell our stories. We have to tell our concern.
Jean-Pierre, we have heard here at the conference about nature-based and technological solutions to removing carbon dioxide. Can you tell us what kind of technological approaches are being tried and what the potential is?
Technological approaches, right. Which are scary for many people because, you know, they are large scale and some call it geoengineering. I will take an example of one of those approaches. It's bringing alkaline material. That is, an alkaline material is an antacid.
Right.
So they are antacids, mostly rocks on land that can be crushed, and then when they go into, they are delivered to the ocean. They increase what we call the alkalinity of the ocean. It's an antacid, and it enables the seawater to take up CO2 and transfer it into a form of carbon that is not exchanged with the atmosphere.
Right.
So it's a way to take CO2 from the atmosphere and put it in a safe reservoir.
It's a bold approach to helping keep climate change to a reasonably safe level, but it's an experiment on the world's ocean.
Maybe I'm wrong and maybe I'm being naive, but sometimes I feel that mankind does step in with these interventions and then we realise we didn't fully understand the problem and then we've caused another problem.
Yes. You're right. At the same time, what are we doing today?
Yeah.
We are doing a geoengineering experiment by using fossil fuels and releasing CO2 in the atmosphere. So that is an experiment that has gone wrong. Yes. Yeah. So I agree that using another geoengineering approach to try to stabilize climate can be seen as unsettling to some people. At the same time, what is the cost of inaction?
But still, you warned in the plenary session, Jean-Pierre, private sector innovation must not be allowed to get too far ahead of our shared scientific understanding. And most of the ocean is outside any governmental control.
I am sometimes nervous to see that the private industry is ahead of science. So I'm very much for the link and the partnership between the private industry and science. But the lack of governance is a real problem because today it is the Wild West in the open seas. You know, any company can do almost whatever it wants. Not for ocean alkalinity enhancement, for example, but there are companies dumping tons of wood pellets to the deep ocean without knowing what is going to happen. I think this has to be under governance. I don't know, I'm not a political scientist myself. I don't know how this can be done, but this is a major issue for the open ocean.
We heard today from New Zealand's coastal navigator, Jack Thatcher, how ancestors shared stories and stored knowledge in artworks, canoes, and songs. And members from the traditional owners of the Great Barrier Reef highlighted their role in supporting and influencing decision-making in reef management, as well as taking part in the co-design and co-delivery of conservation programs in Australia and the Pacific. Now, you've achieved a great deal as scientist, and you talk there about how scientists need to get more engaged with all these other groups that are looking beyond your own work. But what does the global community need to do first? Jean-Pierre, why don't you talk us through those next steps?
Everyone has a role to play, every company also has a role to play, and we see that in carbon credits being delivered in the EU will perhaps help restore some marine ecosystems. I think, but from a stakeholder point of view, there are two things which are critical. Mm. The first thing is to improve tremendously the amount of funding delivered to science. Not only to science, but also traditional knowledge. There is a very big human and social aspect also to everything we have discussed here. Yeah. One needs to bring the whole community, the whole populations together in the same direction.
That's a big ask, isn't it?
It is a big ask. This is why we need the human and social scientists to work on this topic as well. So increase the support, and it could come also from the private industry. Secondly, there are many international agreements that can help the ocean to stay healthy and resilient. They just need to be implemented.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Paris Agreement is a fantastic framework. It has been 21 years in the making, so it was a big success,
yes,
but it's just a framework,
yeah.
And now it has to be implemented. And we saw last year at COP28 in Dubai, so that is 7 years after the Paris Agreement was approved, that progress has been very, very, very slow, and there are still resistance. When one says, one needs to transition out of fossil fuels, there is still a lot of resistance from companies and some individuals.
We're still hoping to a degree because we're not seeing the action that really should be flowing.
There is also a bottom-up aspect to it. You know, obviously, citizens have some power during elections to elect candidates that are favorable to actions in this area. There are also some groups are being established for the scientific community is frustrated with the fact that despite all the alarms dating many years ago, there is action is still slow. But importantly, it is slow, but it happens.
Right.
That must be mentioned. You know, we are no longer today on track with what the projections that that were published in 2015. And at the time of the Paris Agreement, we were going to a global warming of 4 degrees or more. Now we are, due to climate action, we are more on a target of 3 degrees, which is in 2100, which is far more than the Paris Agreement objectives. But it demonstrates that there is action. It is too slow. So what I was saying is that some scientists are very frustrated with this situation, and there is even an organization which was launched called Scientist Rebellion. Maybe you heard about it, and which demonstrates, do demonstrations to try to raise the attention of the public and decision makers to the fact that the climate and the ocean require much more attention than what it has received so far.
Thank you, Jean-Pierre. It really brings home to me how slow our progress has been. If scientists are taking to the streets to make their voices heard. And here at the Ocean Decade, we've seen how urgent it is to have every voice heard. You've both shown Eileen and Jean-Pierre that scientific leaders also need to lead in communicating their findings. They need to talk to their own communities and to policymakers, locally and globally. No forum is perfect, and more needs to be done to amplify the voices of the most vulnerable and least heard. But we are moving forward. We all know what the problem is. We can develop and deliver the data we need to provide solutions, as you've been working on, Pooja, in Italy. Now we just need the sense of hope, the faith in ourselves as a species, to act on that knowledge and data. We need to act. We'll be back with another live recording from the Ocean Decade Conference in 2 weeks' time. Don't forget to subscribe to Planet Beyond Podcast on your favourite app. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode, please do share it with your network. Until then, be safe, be remarkable, be the difference.